When I experienced that sexual abuse, I definitely dissociated. I was on the ceiling looking down at what was happening to me. And I said very clearly to myself, not once you get older, but once you are bigger, this will never happen to you again.
You're listening to Alchemical Voices, a podcast exploring the lives of BIPOC, transracial adoptees, and survivors of complex trauma. Hi, I'm Jaslyn, your host, a nurse, and trauma release practitioner, curiously observing the human experience. As a Black woman and survivor of human trafficking, I've encountered many, many hardships. On the road to recovery, I discovered that storytelling unites us at heart and is where we find healing, inspiration, and encouragement. In each episode, you will hear stories from courageous souls, and we will touch on subjects such as identity confusion, the impacts of racism, complex trauma, transracial adoption, and much more. How do we rise amid trials and tribulations? How do we invite softness into our lives? We touch on these and many other questions, so tune in to experience transformative storytelling and let's heal together.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the Alchemical Voices podcast. In the studio today is Julia Wiedemeyer, and I am so excited for you all to hear her story, her journey, and what she has created out of her trauma to support other trauma survivors. Julia, welcome.
Thank you so much, Jaslyn. And it's really important to me to show up and use my pronouns as part of my community. So I go by she, her, hers. And I'm coming to you today from Colorado Springs, Colorado in the United States, which stands on the homeland and unceded historical territory of many Native and Indigenous people. And so I just want to take a moment to honor these Indigenous communities, the land, the people, the wisdom that I feel that I carry with me. And today I'd like to come to your podcast audience through my intersectional identities, which are kind of the filter through which I live my life, really. And even though I acknowledge that I'm highlighting ignored voices by doing this, I know that simultaneously I kind of exclude other voices just by my level of privilege. And so it's also important for me to just share that, you know, no story is more important than the other. And this is really just my, simply my lived experience. And, you know, I identify my positionality as a Caucasian cisgender lesbian woman living with physical disabilities, recovering from many, many, many addictions, both to substances and behaviors, and also surviving some pretty complex trauma injuries. And I'm living right now in the neighborhood where many of those injuries took place. And so it's kind of recently been another phase of my recovery where I am really self-identifying myself as the cycle breaker for my family, not just family of origin, but really ancestral, you know, all the things that have been carried through. And I don't know how much maybe listeners are aware, but they're saying now in epigenetics, just like what gets carried through as far as, you know, our genetic makeup, that much of the genetic tags even can come from trauma, can come from addiction. And we used to think that that meant it would affect seven generations, but now they're saying it affects 14 generations down the road. And although I'm not a parent and I'm not ever going to be in a position to have children of my own, and that we might get into that, I just feel it's really important to stop the cycle, because as an individual, if I do that in my life, then I do that. I am kind of the light for other people to do the same thing. And so I really feel moved to start with a little saying that I've had since the 90s. And it just feels important to start here. So in the moment of silence, in this moment of silence, I honor myself, my light, my path. I honor the places in me that are still wounded and in need of healing. I honor the places in me that are healed and that I'm appreciative and grateful for them. I honor the light that has been shining in me since the day of my birth, and I promise to continue to travel along this journey, supporting and loving myself through every step. And the one thing that I've learned, and then we'll just do a little silence and we can get into the meat of everything, is that through my addiction recovery, I know that sharing stories is one of the ways we recover. And that's why I think I was right time, right place in finding your podcast, because it's an unapologetic way of folks being able to share their experience, strength, and hope on their journey. And, you know, I know that what I share comes through me, and that it's just meant for the right time, right place. And so the power that's greater than me can, and that's what I'm going to use as we come together today.
Beautiful. So beautiful. And was it a poem that you read, or was it something that you have written?
Well, yourself? it's a beginning of a prayer, and I've had this since the 90s, and it ends Om Shanti Amen. And so I need to find actually the source of this. I know I don't feel like I wrote it. Maybe. But it was in a stack, and I've been kind of on an archaeological dig from my life. So so that's part of this. Really, I guess maybe the best way to frame this is, you know, growing up, I kind of felt like I never really fit in anywhere. You know, it was kind of a volatile situation at home, never really knowing what sorts of explosive emotions would happen, who wasn't talking to who, you know, all of that kind of thing. And, you know, I learned very differently. I was, probably a student that was really delayed in learning how to read and write, lots of bullying and harassment, not just from students, but also from a teacher that, ended up separating me from my classmates in sixth grade, where in the middle of the year, I transferred to a different elementary school, and some of us had been going to school together since kindergarten, and many of us graduated 12th grade together. So that was a trauma, a lot of bullying because of my size and wearing glasses and having braces and all of those kinds of things. But I never really had a felt sense of the complex trauma pieces and its effects until I got sober and clean. Okay, so I graduated, went to a private liberal arts college, which was a women's college in the Midwest of Missouri. and graduated there. And that was the first time I really had a lot of success academically, because it was small, it was single sex. We didn't have to compete with our male counterparts so much, you know? And so I was kind of a super achiever in overdrive there, and really had a lot of academic success. I went into education, elementary and secondary, and psychology, a double major. And the reason I chose that school is from the very get-go, we were in a laboratory classroom. So they had an elementary children's school and kindergarten and two preschool classes. And so, you know, it was very hands-on, and that's the best way that I learn, is hands-on. And so then I decided to choose a job. I was offered some jobs, and I chose to do a recruiting job as an admissions counselor for my alma mater. And that took me to Columbus, Ohio, and I traveled 9 states recruiting for my alma mater. And that's where the addictions to alcohol, cigarettes, marijuana got really, really serious for me. I think I did some exploring in undergrad, but when I was by myself, alone, traveling, it brought up a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt in me. And so not to make excuses or to use addiction as an excuse, but I found myself actually doing things that I didn't believe in, stealing money from where I work to be able to go and get my fixes. I was working at home before working at home was the thing. And so I created my own schedule. I created my own expense accounts, the whole 9 yards. And actually there was quite a significant period of time where for, I would say, 9 months, I woke up at 3-ish in the afternoon, went to the store, got alcohol, cigarettes, large amounts of food, and just sat on the couch, numbed out in front of the TV, watching Oprah, whatever it was, and just medicating myself. And there was never really a realization as to why this was happening. But on one of the Oprah episodes, she had said, you know, she had interviewed someone about addiction. And so there was a part of me that must have recognized I might need help in the future, because I called the area AA Alcoholics Anonymous office in Columbus. And that's when, you know, before the internet and all that was really established, and they sent me a paper copy of the meetings, you know. And so one day I went through, and this is after about 9 months of this pattern of just eating and drinking and smoking and using marijuana until I just passed out, and then doing it the whole next day over and over and over again. And one day, clear as I can remember, I remember where I was, my apartment on Tamarack Boulevard, Columbus, Ohio. I walked into the bathroom, and I never would look in the mirror, but this day I looked in the mirror and I saw death in my face. My face was gray. It looked as though I was the walking dead, and it scared the living shit out of me. So what did I do? I beelined and found that meeting list. And I realized that the next meeting, I said, wherever the next meeting is, I'm going. And I took, you know, it was just a block away at a church literally a block away. So I went there, and that began my recovery journey. Now, here's the thing about recovery that, you know, a lot of people don't realize is that for me, there wasn't a lot of talk, and I still see traditional 12-step recovery is not very trauma-informed or resiliency-informed. And so that was not as low as my bottom got, because what happened was, and thank goodness I was part of the 12-step community by then, but I was pretty much proving the non-existence of a higher power in my life. Like, how could there be a source of good if I was in this much pain? And so somebody smart aleck alcoholic said to me, well, you know, that chair could be your higher power. And I said, what do you mean? You know, that sounds crazy to me. And he said, because it's holding you up when you can't hold yourself up. And so slowly but surely, that concept grew and changed and morphed. But really, the bigger piece was I lost my job because my company car was stolen. And then there was this whole, you know, you need help, you need to get help, we're gonna, you know. So I then came to realize that I was going to be destitute because I didn't have a savings. I didn't have transportation. You know, my car was gone, all my territory, you know, no job and so on. So everyone in program kept saying, just, you know, believe in your higher power, turn it over. You just gotta have faith. Things will get better. And I came home after getting someone to come and pick me up, go to a meeting, come back. I came home, and that's when we had the answering recordings, you know, with the cassettes, and I played my messages from when I was gone. And there was a person on there that said, oh, you know, we did this back when you worked here, which was the job that I lost. And I really want to recommend you for a job coming open that's just going to be about an hour and a half away from where you are. It's, you know, an assistant dean of admissions position. You know, I think it'd be great. So that whole thing worked out, and it took me to a new place. And simultaneously, Jaslyn, I started working, and it was a pretty prestigious job. I got into my first relationship with a woman, and I enrolled in my counseling graduate program. And I was still trying to do my 12-step recovery, but I recognized that it was too triggering or activating for me. I would hear stories of sexual violence, and I didn't understand the reaction I was having within my own self, because I had no recollection of any of that. And I really feel like my addictions were medicating and push. Anytime that tried to surface, I would push it down with large quantities of food. Now, this whole food thing was my primary addiction, even though I chose to do alcohol and then marijuana and then smoking. The food was always my primary addiction. And even in alcohol, you know, AA, it was, well, here, have a donut and a cup of coffee with 6 sugars in it, because that will make you feel better. And that, you know, you'll get through the desire to drink. But I did not realize that what was happening in the brain was still that dopamine hit of the processed sugar or the flour or whatever. So my first relationship was very violent and very sexually abusive. And I kind of thought, you know, and I even sought help. I was doing individual therapy because I realized I wanted to continue my 12-step recovery, but I couldn't do it in a group. I needed the safety of that one-on-one. And so I am trying to become a counselor, you know, getting help from a counselor. And in this first relationship with a same-sex relationship, and I realized that that is when my body really started to dissociate. I didn't have the alcohol and the marijuana and now the smoking to push things down. And so when I was doing that initial healing of my CPTSD symptoms in the late 80s, early 90s, that there wasn't, at least where I was, there wasn't a focus on trauma-informed care. It was very re-triggering for me. Anytime I did the emotional work, I then would have periods of losing time, not having recall of getting from my therapy back to wherever I was, and even experiences where I would kind of come out of a trance-like state in my therapist's office. And I was so afraid, I guess, in what I was relaying to them, I would be in a corner, you know, covering myself like this. And for those of people who aren't seeing this, you know, just like my arms around my knees, kind of hugging myself. And or hiding under her desk. And it was really, really like there was this paradox of, do I want to learn really how to do this with people? I mean, isn't there a better way to do stuff like this, you know, and to heal? And so I would say from that point to now, I've done about on and off about 31 years total of individual counseling. So I feel like I've made quite a lot of progress in those symptoms and just knowing other ways of being able, you know, to make a difference. And it was shortly after that that I came to doing Reiki and energetic healing too. So that was always something that was really nourishing to my nervous system. I didn't have that language, but just to settle things down for me. So I'm going to jump fast forward ahead because it really, I would say the last 5 years of my recovery, I have had a new phase. And so I think many people probably here would know about Judith Herman, maybe not. She's a medical doctor in the United States that has developed the three phases of trauma recovery and healing. And I just listened recently to a interview that she did where she's thinking of adding the fourth phase. And that's where I feel that I'm at. And she said, with all the work she's done with PTSD and CPTSD survivors, there's really like this final phase where they, you know, survivors have said many, many times that they want either acknowledgement from the perpetrator or for the bystanders that were there to take responsibility. And I really feel that's where I am at. Okay, so 2019, December 5th, I remember the exact date, December 5th, 2019, I decided, because I had started on the US Thanksgiving, which would have been, you know, a couple weeks prior to that in November, that every time I'm with my family of origin, we celebrate through addiction. People go crazy with the alcohol, smoking, gambling, you know, what's the football game? Let's have a football pool, overeating. And I thought, if I can address my processed food addiction, which is the last layer of the onion, then and I can do it on Thanksgiving Day, then I can do it. I'll one day at a time, I'll just try to do it. So I joined a processed food addiction recovery program December 5th of 2019. You know, the big crux of that program was not to just find a food plan that worked for your system, but to also do the inner work, because I honestly, Jeslyn, I have lost and gained and lost and gained more and lost and gained more and done the pay to weigh programs my whole entire life. And it was another way that I felt I didn't fit in. My body, I had stopped weighing myself on the physical body scale at that point. I was 351 pounds. And so I decided I'm going to do this. I'm going to do the recommended inner work. Then the pandemic happens and everything goes online. Now, mind you, I had had, previous to this whole plan, I had had pretty much a mental breakdown. I had left my last long-term relationship, and that was the longest relationship I had had. And I decided to move back to the house I grew up in with my parents for an emotional reset, which turned into years and years and years, because 351 plus pound Julia was codependent, found my worth through doing and being for my elderly parents, was a people pleaser. So I didn't want to rock the boat and say, hey, you know, siblings, you have to get involved with the care of our elderly parents. And so I was really at a low point and didn't realize it. So we did the inner work in this group, was IFS, or internal family systems focused. And it was looking at, this is the best way I explain it to the people that I've sponsored, is that it was looking at the versions of myself that were still stuck in trauma time. Okay. And befriending them, dialoguing with them, helping them unburden all of what they've been carrying so that I could be more integrated and feel more physically, emotionally, spiritually present in the moment. And I really learned that, you know, as I was recovering with my food addiction, and so I lost almost half my body weight. I released almost half my body weight, approximately 160 pounds. And one of the things that was such a dichotomy for me is that I realized I had trained and been a helper, both as a counselor, as a behavior specialist, as a lay minister, in a congregation here in Colorado Springs as a deacon. Throughout my life, I've always been a helping professional. And the crux of a lot of that had been helping people acknowledge their feelings and emotions, and then creating a path forward from there, okay? But I realized for the first time that I had a complete inability without pushing the food, without using the food to push my feelings down, to even identify and try to experience what I was feeling. So, you know, I was drawn to the IFS, you know, we call it PERTS work, the PERTS work, because in PERTS work, part of what happens is, for me, this is just my experience, is that all the time along, you're developing more whole self energy. And the self energy is coming from the 8 C's and 5 P's of IFS. And I'm just going to read these to you because sometimes I forget them. But yes. The C's are compassion, clarity, calm, creativity, courage, connection, curiosity, and confidence. And as a survivor of CPTSD, I mean, I've had 3 fires. I've lost people to suicide that were my best friends. I had a schoolmate. And I remembered this all after getting sober. I had a schoolmate in 2nd or 4th grade. I only remember the teacher, and I had Mrs. Uhas, and I had her for both 2nd and 4th grade. I lost a dear friend of mine early in my life. I remembered being part of a ritualistic sexual abusive situation. And so I never had any of those 8 C's up until doing this internal work, because I was so fearful, uncertain, and doubtful of what I was remembering. Was it true? Did I need to run it past someone? And here's the thing I know. The addict's mind becomes dependent on the external. And this work for me was about internal. I don't have to have a reality check by any one person anymore. What I remember as my experience is what I'm going on until I know better. And so then the 5 P's are presence, perspective, patience, persistence, and playfulness. Wow, that is out of my comfort zone, because everything in my family was so serious, so serious, so serious. Everything in my life was, recovery was serious, becoming a counselor and an energetic healing provider was serious, serious work. And now I see all along the people who made really gentle attempts to try to introduce playfulness. And I just was so rigid. My nervous system was so bracing and efforting for every single thing that I couldn't bring these things in at all, at all, at all. And so what happened in the releasing of 160 pounds is I stopped the weight loss 2 years and 1 day after my start date, because that day I had had somebody in my family took a picture of me that I was going to post online and say, you know, celebrating 2 years of being in the weight loss phase. And for the first time in my life, I looked at a picture of myself and I had self-satisfaction. That had never been. Every single time I had seen a picture of myself up to that point, and I stopped literally taking pictures of myself and my life because I saw such shame and such just the self-blame. Like, how could you let yourself get to this place? That it was really painful. And for me to look at that picture and declare, I don't care if I lose another ounce. And that's what this recovery has shown me. It wasn't about losing weight and fitting in, which is what it's been my whole entire life. It was about the change between my two ears, the changing in my the neurobiology of my brain, because now the dopamine wasn't downregulating and creating this addiction pathway. And I could create new neural pathways in my brain of self-love and self-acceptance. And so I learned that next year to maintain, which meant adding food in, which was a little uncomfortable and destabilizing. And right as I was getting to about my 1 year mark, some pretty profound things happened. I had a very generous person in my family bought me a house in the neighborhood that I live in, a family member and their spouse. And so I was going to finally have my own space. When I lived with my parents, especially during the pandemic, there were all sorts of paranoid like things going on, like you can't have people over, you know, you can't do this, you got to do that, blah, 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 blah. So I was really looking forward to having my own space, being able to be like in a relationship if I wanted to again, you know, all of that. And I closed on the house the first night I was in the house here overnight, you know, staying like, I didn't have a bed yet, but I slept in a recliner. I wake up the next morning and the Club Q shooting happened in Colorado Springs. And so for your international listeners, they might not be aware of that, but this is what it was, kind of a simultaneous thing of I've gotten to this place where I have to rewind a bit. Okay, before we talk about the Club Q shooting. In that year of really working on my maintenance journey and finding out how much food I needed to add to stop the weight loss, the whole entire time, I had a really toxic relationship with the body scale. And I had to stop weighing my body and kind of do it based on how clothes were fitting, how hungry I felt or not. And up to that point, I never really registered hungry or full. I just ate and ate and ate because I was in so much pain. So my brain never registered full. Anyway, so part of this is that I had to deal with the message that happened for me when I was dissociating. And this, let's just brace ourselves and take care of ourselves, breathe through this. When I recalled the ritualistic sexual abuse, okay, that was multiple adults, both, you know, male and female, lots of children. And what happened in that situation was, for me, a moral injury, okay? When I think of a moral injury, it means having to do things or really being forced to do things that you would have never done in your entire life. And what it did to me is I recognized that when I was asked who should be next, which nobody being abused should ever have to do that, not only would that next person be tortured and sexually molested and sexually abused, but I had to witness that. And it felt on some real level like I was part responsible. And so a big piece of 12-step recovery is making amends. And I know even if I found those people, it might cause them more harm than good to make amends to them. And this is kind of a sidetrack to where we were, but it's important because When I experienced that sexual abuse, I definitely dissociated. I was on the ceiling looking down at what was happening to me. And I said very clearly to myself, not once you get older, but once you are bigger, this will never happen to you again. Okay. Which is the link here. Okay. Do you see? This is the link here, because the felt sense in my body was, I have to be big, enormous, huge, so that I will never have a sexually violent thing happen to me.
Yeah.
And so when I got into a smaller frame, I had to confront that over and over and over again with the IFS, the parts work. Like, here's the version of myself that believes that it's bigger, not older. And I had to talk to that version and say, you know, doesn't it make more sense that it would be older instead of bigger? You know, and to release the whole frame that a big frame means safety. And so this version came to believe through these dialogues that a smaller frame means more health, more ability to get away, and so on. Okay.
Yeah.
Does a part of you feel you're at a standstill healing from your CPTSD symptoms due to feelings of unsafety, embarrassment, unworthiness, and powerlessness? Hi, everyone. My name is Julia Wiedemeyer, and I'm a trained professional counselor who works as an integrative somatic trauma therapist. And I have unlocked for myself the transformative power of embodied somatic polyvagal daily practices to re-regulate my nervous system, releasing stored emotions and unlocking the energy I needed to create a purposeful and thriving new future for myself. If you want to learn these practices for your own healing journey, I have an exciting offer for this podcast listening audience. Go to my website at innervisionresources.com and choose the 90-minute intensive integrative somatic trauma therapy session, usually a $175 US value for only $125 when you book your appointment using my sliding scale option. Our essential focus during this initial session will be on your unique unburdening needs, both emotionally and energetically, for you and your system, establishing whole person healing that not only nourishes your mind, body, and spirit, but also your life. So please visit my website at innervisionresources.com today to take advantage of this limited time offer ending on December 31st. I also invite you to join my online healing community at Innervision Resources on Instagram. Have a beautiful and healing day. So let's go back. So November 19th, I'm staying overnight in my brand new house that's been gifted to me. I'm feeling grateful for that. I'm feeling grateful for the opportunity to have maybe a new partner, friends over, all the restrictions that I couldn't do with when I was living with my parents. And I wake up to somebody, one of my recovery buddies, saying to me, Julia, what do you need? I heard about Club Q. Is everyone you know okay? And I'm like, wait a minute. I was, prior to all of this, I was the lay minister for the congregational care team for the for a church here that predominantly was ministering to that queer umbrella. And we had had fundraisers at this bar for our church. Okay. So it was just so unreal to me. And I started to experience something that was very familiar to me when I had my mental collapse and brought me to Colorado Springs and living for that emotional reset with my parents in the first place, is that I felt fearful, I felt paranoid, and I felt suspicious, like if I leave my home, this is possibly could happen to me. It was really, really profound. And that's where so much, you know, we talked earlier before you started the recording about how when the student is ready, the teacher appears. That's how a plethora of resources came my way, the right therapist at the right time that directed me to Stephanie Fu's book, you know, What These Bones Know, and CPTSD, the diagnosis, and some counselor trainings in regards to that. And then seeing how even in that integrative treatment approach for CPTSD, they use the IFS model many times, the CARTS work model with EMDR and some of the other really, you know, integrative approaches to work towards healing. And so this has been just so such an eye-opening time. And I'm getting ready, you know, for the anniversary date of November 20th coming up. I'm getting ready for the anniversary date of December 5th when I started my processed food addiction, and then December 6th where I will be celebrating this year 3 years of maintaining my, you know, what I've released in this journey. But the big thing, and everybody comments, your physical transformation. Some people don't even know of the physical transformation and just treat me like a normie, is what I say. But the big thing is I always try to reframe, you know, when folks say something about the physical transformation, is what I have learned through psychoeducation, through, you know, re-regulating my nervous system enough to get the felt sense of what the feeling is and to be able to express it authentically. And, you know, here's what I know. If people aren't willing to hear that, find new people. Because here's the thing that I found in that whole journey, this whole journey within the last 5 years, but specifically the last 2 years, is people pleasing doesn't serve me. Codependency doesn't serve me. And being in situations with people, places, and things that do not serve my highest good or fit with my recovery and my CPTSD healing, there will be other people. And it's okay. I didn't even share this, Jaslyn, that in April, I will turn 60 years old, okay? And so here's the thing. Here's the thing about that. Every single time that I'm in, you know, a 9 year, like this year is I'm 59 and it's a 9 year going into the next decade, I always do kind of a life, what do they call it when you get ready to pass, a life review. I always do a life review. And one of the things that's been so profound in this life review is as I have been unpacking some boxes that have been packed up since my last relationship ended, which was almost, oh my goodness, like 17 years ago now, I am archiving my life. I am seeing the relationships where love existed and I blocked it because I was so full of defense and full of, no, recovery is serious and we can't let play in or joy in. We have to be serious, serious, serious. And, you know, I guess the one thing that I've learned as a studier of spiritual traditions of all ages and all nations is something from A Course in Miracles, which is only the love is real. And here's the thing that I want to end on, and then I can't believe I've talked so long, is that if only the love is real, then hurt people hurt people. And I can recognize now, through the rage, through the 9 months of grief, that relationships in my family of origin are never going to be the way that I want them to be. I'm never going to have acknowledgement from the perpetrators, the bystanders. And I was rageful and then profoundly in grief. And I feel like I'm finally coming out of that with the recognition that hurt people hurt people. And when there's a moral injury, like what occurred for me with having to participate in a forced way to the I don't even know how to describe this, to the abuse of other people by having to say, you're next, and witness it. I know I have done to myself and probably inadvertently done to others what has been done to me. Yeah. And that is my work from this point forward. And, you know, I have a deep desire to just make the world a better place and help people heal in profound ways. And if my story can lead someone to that, all the better. Yeah. All the better to know it was worth it in some yeah. way, shape, or form to overcome.
Yeah. Yeah. And I even mean you created, I'm sorry, I forgot what it's called. Inner vision resources, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that is also you on a mission to help others, you know, heal trauma, conquer whatever they survived. And in my opinion, that is alchemy. You have alchemized your lived experiences by deciding, I'm going to heal as much as I can, as profoundly as I can, and then I'm going to help others. And I was just wondering, while listening to your storytelling, do you think that you went through all these academical, educational, all these, you know, the Reiki, every education course, everything that you've achieved, do you think that on a subconscious level that you were running from yourself by taking all these courses and wanting to help others was in reality because you wanted help desperately yourself?
Oh, absolutely, 100%. I think that's one of the dichotomies of being a healer and helping other people heal is, you know, it's kind of like what they say, you know, the healing has to happen for yourself, for things to gain momentum enough for you to draw in. And that's really where I feel I'm at, is this kind of turning point. You know, and I feel a little bit at a disadvantage because I don't really understand the technology and all the things that people are doing. And I'm a little behind the ball as far as all of that goes. But, you know, I do see that Yeah, lived experience. My lived experience was always about other. See, this is the attic brain. It's outside. I was always focusing on the other, my parents, my partner, my siblings, my spiritual community, my recovery community. And within the last 5 years, I have finally said, that's all well and good. It may or may not serve you, but you have to be putting yourself in the forefront. And, you know, for the longest time, I think that moral injury of, you know, the moral injuries that I have had in my life made this self-shame, self-blame, guilt spiral happen within me that never allowed me to put myself first, my needs first, my priorities, my values first. My values are what's driving my life now, not the other way around. It used to be, well, you know, so-and-so needs me to do this for them first before realizing or recognizing that might not be in my best interest on this day at this time. You know, maybe I need to do some body work or whatever to take care of myself.
I've never heard the term moral injury. This is the first time I'm hearing it, but it resonates with me on such a profound level because I recognize how you explain it. I recognize my own journey and feelings of self-blame and self-shame. And because of this self-blame and self-shame, there were parts of me that were convinced they were unworthy and undeserving of XYZ. And because I'm not good enough, and if only I had been good enough, then I would be able to put myself first. You know, where I am now on my healing journey and what I have come to understand is self-compassion is the antidote. That's essentially what I'm trying to say. You know, as you said before, what I was doing and what I was told to do and that I was next, it wasn't my fault. Yeah, I did it, but were you a child when this happened to you?
Yes.
Yeah. So you were a child, you were under massive influence, and you were just seeing what was modeled to you. How on earth were you supposed to oppose and not do what you were being told? You probably would have been harmed. There could have been serious consequences.
Right.
So, like, communicating to those parts, it wasn't your fault. You didn't really have a choice. You were in a situation where you were at such a big threat that it's a matter of survival. And then you just do what you've got to do, you know? That returning to self-compassion again and again and again and again.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I have found that it's very profound when we move from these external forms of validation, reassurance, reality checks, all of that, to an internal, just knowing I have the physical scars, I have the emotional scars, I have the spiritual scars. I know in every cell of my being that this happened. And for me, it wasn't as important for the perpetrators to take responsibility because many of them are probably gone. Many of them are completely incapable. And some of them are still in my life. And that's been a whole thing of having to go no contact, which, you know, that's a whole thing. And then reintroducing back. But the thing that I will say is, you know, moral injury is kind of fairly new to me too, Jaslyn. And the big thing that I'm recognizing is that, at least here in the Western concept of mental health and recovery and healing. The treatment model is different for people who've experienced moral injury versus PTSD and CPTSD, because for, I'm just going to speak from my experience, that I know my life would have been in danger if I had said, I'm not going to do this. And because of that, I realize through my life, I can see patterns of maladaptive behavior patterns, emotion dysregulation patterns that are linked to doing to myself internally what was done to me externally.
Yes.
So how that would look, let me think of an example. So for instance, during the sexual abuse piece, there was lots of comments about my body, the way it looked, the way it responded, all that, okay? And so I would say to myself, and I did say to myself, starting my processed food addiction, like, weight loss is the thing, because then you'll fit in more, you'll be able to go in and be more social, you're not going to feel so insecure. And I kind of did that same kind of mind control thing to myself internally until I realized it's way more about the internal work than any of that.
The size, the obesity is just a symptom.
Yes.
The addictive behavior, stuffing your face, shoving your emotions down, that bit control, controlling addictive behavior is a symptom. It's actually not at the root. The root is that there's a wound, there's right. pain, there's a
trauma.
Calling. Yeah. Yes.
The trauma injury. And that's
exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and you know, I have found that although, you know, recovery spaces, traditional 12-step spaces, you know, they're, hey, we welcome, you know, this is an open meeting. And yet much of the sharing is trauma-based, trauma dumping, not realizing the effects it has for other people. And I think one of the things that, you know, I just want to be on a soapbox about is, like, if the entrained memory is, you know, when I'm bigger, I'll be safer. You can choose a different way. And the other thing that we didn't even bring up is another intersectional identity of mine, which is feminism. And I think maybe people will hear this and be critical, and I hope they'll just be a little curious about what I'm going to say, is that I think the lens of feminism for me made me very militant for the longest time about, I can be whatever size I want to be, I'm still worthy. But inside, I didn't believe that. Inside, I felt worthless. Inside, I felt shameful. Inside, I felt less than you and you and you and you and you. Yeah. And it doesn't matter if it's the color of your skin, what you believe in religiously or spiritually, if you are in an able body or, you know, you deal with difference. There's so many lenses, socioeconomic background, all of these things play into our willingness to be willing to recover and heal, or our defensiveness and resistance. And for me, the longest time, I mean, I was one of those body positivity, like, fat is beautiful, but inside there were versions of myself that thought being heavy is, you know, completely goes against health, the health that I want for myself, the fact that, you know, I do want to be able to do more things physically. And just a snapshot, like when I was in that 351 pound body, not only was I pushing down the pain every second I was eating, but I was on psychotropic mental health medication. I was on high blood pressure medication. I was on high cholesterol medication. I was getting ready to start some sort of treatment for high blood sugar. I was sleeping an average of 13 and a half hours a night because I was so inactive and exhausted. And the other thing was I had to have oxygen at night because I could not breathe because I was so over, you know, I was like, there's different classes of obesity. I was just at class 4 obesity. And that's dangerous in all respects of the word. And there's so many things that are carried through with heart disease and whatnot in my family that it was really just not even serving me at all. And a big thing, you know, I didn't follow, you know, everybody says your story isn't, you know, the details of what you've experienced aren't really where the healing happens. The healing happens in looking at how you've overcome the strengths you've gained. But there was a part of me that really needed to write down every single thing. And I'm very glad I did, because eventually I'm going to turn this into, you know, a teaching memoir of my life experience. And, you know, I think the thing that's important that I did leave out, and there's lots of other things, you know, that I've survived that maybe most people haven't survived, is that I had a lot of medical trauma. When I talked briefly about, you know, being in my first relationship with a woman, going and doing my 12-step recovery individually with the therapist, and then also starting my training as a counselor, my body remembered before I remembered. So I dealt with cervical dysplasia. I dealt with, which is like a precancerous form of the cervix. I dealt with endometriosis to the point of several emergency surgeries, endometrial tissue wrapped around an ovary and a fallopian tube that needed to be removed in my 20s because I came home from work, the workaholic that I was, and my abdomen was out after resting. I took a nap. I woke up and I had a spontaneous, I don't even remember what they called it, but my right side of my abdomen was as large as a basketball. And my partner took me to, I was living in a small, small town in Ohio, to the nearest hospital, and lots of medical trauma. I actually had my right fallopian tube and ovary removed and didn't give consent for that. You know, I mean, like, and then in 2014, you know, I had, again, the body remembers as things were happening with all of the transitions with, you know, relationships and healing my sexual self and all of that. I went for a regular pap exam in 2014, and the provider said, you know, your right ovary is inflamed. And I said, that's impossible. I don't have a right ovary. Didn't you read my file? I mean, like, I can't believe some of the negligence that has happened in all of this. And so then it went to an ultra, you know, a vaginal ultrasound, which found growths where my ovary and fallopian tube were. So then I had to go to, you know, a special hospital in Denver, and, you know, they did a hysterectomy. Well, when they opened me up, they found stuff that would look like bubble wrap. I don't know if you have that where you are, but bubble wrap is what we, yeah. So in my abdomen, all throughout my abdomen, and they closed me up. And when I woke up, they said, we need to do another surgery. And I said, why? And they said, well, because your abdomen is full of multicystic mesothelioma. It can morph to cancer. We're testing it now. And we want to go in, open you up, and do a chemo wash to burn away all of that tissue. And I said, no. What can I do instead? I mean, yeah. Because at this point, I had moved past do anything. I'm in so much pain in my 20s, you know, which really led to like, what? You took my ovary out and my fallopian tube. You didn't even get permission. Well, you said, do whatever. And it was like all this miscommunication and not really being able to express what I needed, what I wanted. So in this situation, they said, well, just do a scan every year for 5 years. If it doesn't morph or change, then, you know. And so anyway, there's been so much medical trauma because my body tends to remember before the emotions surface. There's a lag time there.
Yeah. And I even think that science, I can't remember which, one it was, but there is a definite link between physical illness and unprocessed trauma, injury. There is a direct link, and that's why it's so important that we process our trauma, because if we don't, it's just going to manifest as illness. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so determined to deal with my shit, you know, and recover as much as I can. And I will be going on to some deep detoxification, cellular regeneration. I know someone in the States that's going to help me. I don't know if you've heard of Carrie Drinkwine, but she's quite known in the States. She's a regenerative health specialist. You know, because that chronic stress and unprocessed trauma, it can do a lot of havoc on the body. So I'm definitely doing what I can to deal with my own stuff. And I recommend that everyone does, you know, because we deserve healing. We deserve, you know, to feel healthy and happy and live in a healthy body that functions, that's not burdened by emotional pain and physical pain because of the emotional pain, you know?
Right.
So that is my wish for every CPTSD survivor, actually.
Yeah. Yes. And I would say, you know, my thinking has super changed on all of what you're talking about, because in the 80s and 90s, when I did my training in psychology, education, and counseling, you know, I still had professors that believed that, you know, the brain is static, it doesn't change, you know, none of this neuroplasticity, no trauma-informed, resilience-informed lenses, okay? Mm. So I feel like I've had to catch up at warp speed to all the new, you know, models and all the new lingo and so on and so forth. And you know, I think that it's really interesting because I feel like energetically, I've had conversations like, you taught me X, Y, and Z about X, Y, and Z to these people, you know, mm-hmm. but that wasn't true. And it really limited not only my thinking, but my life. And so now I want a life of infinite possibilities. Yeah. And to be able to do that and to have vibrant health, vibrant mental health, I need to unlearn so much of what I've been taught. Yeah. And that's from society, that's from family of origin, that's from all of these various structures. Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that's really important for me is not only, you know, having, I failed to mention that most transformative work with the inner work for this layer of, you know, processed food addiction that led to, you got to embrace your feelings and learn how to do them, is going from what I was taught, which is this top, like, think, change your thinking, which will change your feelings, which will change your behaviors and actions, to a bottom-up approach, which is more body-based, regulate your nervous system with somatics that, and I choose every day to do integrative somatic trauma therapy for myself, which is through the polyvagal lens, which just means a balance of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system to re-regulate. And it's bringing that body-based up through the body to the thinking. Yeah. And it clears away the cobwebs of doubt and fear and shame and uncertainty and unworthiness and powerlessness and all of those things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's my experience too. I was in psychiatry for many years. I was pathologized, told that there was something wrong with me. And we worked, as you said, from the top down. So it's the cognitive diamond. In Danish, we say den kognitive diamant. So if I had to translate it directly, it would be the cognitive diamond.
Dialectical?
No.
There's cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's it. So like something happens. You get a feeling. That feeling influences how you have some certain thoughts. Those thoughts determine your behavior, and then it turns into a pattern and blah, 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 blah. We used to do a lot of that, and I would never get any really better. And I did that for years, and I was on medication for years and told her that it's because there's something wrong with you. And once I went into somatics and began to expand my nervous system, began to come out of dissociation. I was so dissociated. I would leave so many sessions after after therapy being completely numb. It was first when I began opening, you know, expanding my window of tolerance.
I then
really could work with my mindset and my limiting beliefs.
Right.
That made a massive shift.
Right.
So, I mean, psychiatry has got it all wrong. I used to be a nurse in psychiatry, and I feel deeply for the patients that are there right now that are being told that they are disordered, that there's something wrong with them, when in reality, the majority of them are deeply traumatized, because most of them, the majority, what I saw, they've been sexually abused or experienced something else really traumatic in their childhood.
You know?
So, yeah,
the whole idea of the pathologizing trauma is such an important topic. And, you know, I mean, I've had providers, and I am not joking. I had one person say to me, do you think if you hadn't been sexually abused by this janitor, male janitor at the country club, well, people were doing X, Y, and Z, that you would be gay? Honestly, like they made the association that just because I shared one experience that was super activating and devastating to me with a man, that meant somehow on some level to them that I chose to be a lesbian because of that. And I mean, there's lots of other things too with all of that. And I think that healers need to heal themselves and to be able to be informed enough of that whole process of what has worked, what hasn't worked, and all of that, to be able to be present for someone else. And the thing that I know is that I am free of all of those things that I mentioned, the mental health medications, the blood pressure, all of those, that laundry list. I no longer do any of those things. Does that mean I don't have a physical health regimen? No. You know, I wake up, I take my blood pressure, I take my supplements, I do my polyvagal informed somatic work in the morning. I take breaks. I've widened my margins, you know, so that if I know I have X, Y, and Z, I used to rush and do as much and effort as much. And my whole system was bracing. Like, what is, what rug is going to be pulled out from under me and what I've planned for today? And that's the way I tried to stay safe, was just going and being a human doing instead of a human being. And really widening my margins is about prioritizing rest and self-care and being able to really be present with people. Present. It's so much different. Because I used to seek my self-importance based on what I did for others.
And it resonates with me. I think most of us, you know, we've all been there on some level. And I do believe that healing, when it comes down to it all, is returning to ourselves. It's returning home.
Absolutely. I've heard you say that a few times on the podcasts of yours that I've listened to. It is a reuniting with self. And here's the thing in parts work IFS, you know, that self energy that gets created, which I have termed, for me, it's my spirit led self. For others, it can be their higher self, their whatever it is. When I'm in that space of the 8 C's and the 5 P's most of the time. And whenever there's a version of myself that bubbles up, that self can be engaged and loving and willing and curious and compassionate to that part, instead of what I got as a child, which is dismissed, discounted. You don't matter. You know, it's such a very different experience.
It is. It is. And it's very beautiful. I think it's beautiful that I recently wrote about it on my Instagram stories. That for years, I was just desperately seeking people to fill that void. And then I wrote, I wish that someone had told me many years ago that the person I was looking for was me.
Absolutely. It doesn't matter how many followers. I know we have this like high pressure thing as people, you know, trying to get the message out. Like, I need X amount and I need, you know, it is really what I prioritize is what's going to bring me the most peace of mind today. And just put in front of me the opportunities, the people, the places, the things that are really the presence of where I need to be.
Julia, thank you so much for being here and sharing your story and your convictions. This conversation has been such an eye-opener. I resonate with you on so many levels, your journey, but I've gotten so many new insights. So thank you for your vulnerability and your authenticity. And is there something you would like to say before we end to the audience?
Absolutely. And I thought about this a lot. And I'm going to borrow something from Lisa Dian, who is a mental health practitioner in Boulder. And this is on her website. It says, quote, "Trying to be someone you are not is futile and will always create huge amounts of inner conflict and chaos over time. So have the courage to walk your own path, find your own voice, create your own rhythm, and do life your way."
Oh my God.
I couldn't encapsulate what I wanted to say better than that.
Thank you so much. No, it's so beautiful. And the reason why I'm having this reaction is because I recently wrote to my friend on my tombstone, it's going to say, "I did it my way." So it seems very synchronistic. Like, that's why.
Spiritual synchronicities. Yes. Spiritual synchronicities for sure. Would I be able to just tell folks how to reach me on social and all that? Okay, so on Instagram, it's at Inner Vision Resources, and my website is juliawiedemeyer.com, but most people don't know how to spell my last name. So if you don't know, you can go to innervisionresources.com as well. And please stay in touch, Jaslyn. I would love to stay in touch after this. It was really, really, really very heartfelt for me to do this with you. I so appreciate what you're doing. You are a bright light out there, being unapologetic and giving space, holding space for all of us in all the various ways. And I really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you so much.
You are so, 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 so welcome. Really, truly you are.
That was it for today. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to rate Alchemical Voices and follow the community on Instagram. Until next time.